Well, part of the trouble with stories is so often, you know, you'll hear a story and you get maybe intrigued by a portion and then I don't finish it. I know that's frustrating. I despise it when other people do it to me. And so I was asked, what happened to my luggage? Well, I think this is a funny story. My mother actually picked the luggage up. And so when I got my bag back, my $9,995 was missing. That woman pocketed my drug money. I guess it's not that comical, but I thought that's what a good mom ought to do. Well, let me take us back to the three categories. We have a sense of God's plan. It involves leaving. It involves a kind of cleaving together and then weaving, and that is what we'll refer to as one flesh. So what we're going to do, I think it's, let's see what the manual does. So it's on page 10, 11 and 12. What we'll talk about is what it means to leave, what it means to cleave together, and then what it means to become one flesh. So all we're trying to articulate at this juncture is, what's God's plan? Know the simple category is, when you violate the plan, there are consequences. And we all violate it. That's what we're going to be coming to in the Roman numeral number 4. We all fail. And what we do with failure almost is more important than how we're, in one sense, aligning ourselves with the plan. So we've got two categories we're going to go back and forth to. What is God's plan? What happens when we violate it? And how do we indeed rebuild, restore, and revitalize our relationship to become more what we would wish for it to be? That's sort of what we've been doing over this next hour and a half and a portion of our last session. First category, leave. I said two things initially. One is, you do not leave geographic and think that you have left. This has nothing to do with geography. It has nothing to do with whether or not you live in a separate state or home. Why? Because in the ancient Near East, families lived together. 60, 70, 80 people living virtually under one roof. Again, it's an obvious sentence, but it is so important for you to hear that the scriptures are being lived out as they were written far closer in family structure in Asia and in Africa than what we know in America. The Bible is written with a familial culture, not a Western nuclear family orientation. So our notion of family is in and of itself fragmented compared to what the scriptures think of when they think of a family. And I'm not so much, again, commending or condemning our own culture as simply to say, when you read the Bible, you need to be aware that Africa, Asia, has a clearer sense of what family is from the scriptures than what we tend to have in our Western independent world. So given that, what is leaving? It is not physical departure. Second, it has nothing to do with your financial independence. You could right now be receiving, as a 50-year-old, $20,000 a year from your family as a beneficiary of a trust. Does that mean you have not left your family? This has nothing to do with money. So why? Because in the ancient Near East, economically, all families would have been intertwined together. So again, not arguing that's the route we should be moving. I simply want you to hear the nature of what it means to leave has to do with an issue of the heart. And it has to do with the issue of loyalty. To whom will you be most loyal with the matters of your heart? The best way for me to illustrate is to tell you the story of our own marriage. And certainly for almost a decade and a half, with grief I say, my wife and I fought more over in-laws than any other portion of our lives. Not there weren't struggles sexually or with our children or finances. Those are the top four that most people, 75% of most marriage conflicts fit into those four categories. In-laws, sex, money, children. We struggled in all those areas, but the one that seemed to bring the greatest heartache was how we were engaged in one another's families. So when we would return to my mother or father's home, her mother or father's home, day or two would go moderately well, and then things would sink. And 4 or 5 days later, we'd be barely holding together. We would depart, go back to our home, and it would take a week to 2 weeks to recover, and then things were much better. Sometime after my father died, we were visiting my mother, and it was probably 7 o'clock in the evening, and my wife said to me, casually, just it wasn't a major conversation, she said, will you be going to bed early tonight? And I said, no, but why are you asking? She said, well, I'm wanting to make plans for the kids and me, and you've been going to bed early the last three nights, so I didn't know whether to count you or not. And I said, I haven't gone to bed early. And she said, you have. You know these moments, don't you? There are 1,000 better ways to handle it, but my response was the fairly typical angry, defensive, self-righteous, arrogant response, which was, no, I didn't. And she said, honey, I knew you'd say that, and so in my calendar, I marked the exact moment on my watch that you went to bed. And I said, you've been keeping track of time? She said, yes, because I knew that you wouldn't admit that you've been going to bed. And I said, well, so when did I go to bed yesterday? She said, about 7:15. I said, I didn't go to bed. She goes, honestly, maybe I need to be a little more precise. I don't know where you went, but you went upstairs and you went into the bedroom that we sleep in. What you were doing up there, I didn't come to see. I'm simply saying you departed from the family at 7:15 and you didn't return. And I'm going, oh, okay. Well, the day before, 7:30. Really? So the pattern became clear. And she said, is this like new data to you? I suppose. She said, oh, honey, you change when you're around your mom. What do you mean? Well, first of all, you don't touch me when you're around your mother. What do you mean I don't touch you? You don't kiss me. You don't put your hand on my shoulder. You don't put your arm around me. That's not true. Dan, are you aware that before you come to Columbus, you get sick? Or while we're here, you get ill? Or you get sick within a few days after departing? That is not true. Would you like to see my calendar and diary? No. I would love to say I'm a brighter, godlier man than I am. As I said to you at the very beginning, if I need to be a paragon for you as to how to live, all I can tell you is I didn't see it. I'm a psychologist. I work with people. I help people with their lives. You think any of us who do that kind of work really are that bright and capable of looking at our own lives? I'd much rather look at your life than mine. So when I have somebody sort of turn the mirror and help me begin to look at my own life, it's like, that's not true. That's not true. And then when the data is there, I have a really hard time saying. And what I said to my wife at this time was, it just sort of came out. I said to her, honey, I know at least a large portion of what you're saying must be true. But my mother, and here were the words, my mother needs me to be that kind of son to her for 1 week. And I can't believe the next sentence came out, but it did. It did. And I said to her, you get me for 51 weeks, and she gets me for one. Like, that's a great gift, but no. But when my wife looked at me and she goes, that seems to have a little problem with regard to leaving. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It does. So when you're trying to balance loyalties, you have already violated what God desires. When you're trying to negotiate loyalties, look, I'm only around you for 1 week a year, so isn't it okay that my somewhat dependent, somewhat fragile, somewhat needy mother, who's dependent upon me for most of her life, for life, would get a large portion of me? But given that I'm with you most of the other time, and I hope I'm a focused, committed, loving husband, can't we just sort of live with this balance? And the answer is, no, you can't. When you go home loyal, not to your family, not to your culture, not to your race, not to your world, but to your spouse. That's what God calls us to no one else, to our spouse. So when we talk about weddings, when I began talking with my children about, two of them have been married, and so to talk with them about, and I've been unbelievably privileged with both my son and daughter to be asked to perform the wedding. And as I have done so, what I have asked them to think about is, how do you want to address this issue of leaving? And both of them went, oh, no. Oh, no, I don't want to deal with that. Why? Well, because you're not as open as you think, Dad. and my in-laws have never heard that concept quite put in that way, and we're not sure what will happen. And to go, well, I've got an honor, but I also must be faithful to what I believe. And I'm not going to require you to do it, but on the other hand, there has to be a portion of the ceremony. And I said, here's what I would prefer, especially for the wedding I paid for. You know, I'd asked each of them, how long did you want the wedding to be? And the figure was usually used somewhere between like 20 and 40 minutes, preferably at the 20, more so than at the 40. And I'm thinking, are you crazy? I mean, we didn't pay what the average American wedding costs, but we paid a lot. And I'm not about to have a ceremony that lasts 20 minutes for what we paid. So I said, no, here's what I'd recommend. Let's think in the realm of 2 to 3 hours. minimum 3 to 5 days for, and I mean that, I mean literally, that why have a wedding on a Saturday night? You know, bring people in on a Thursday, Friday, do the, no, this needs to be an event. Weddings need to become events, 3-day, 4-day, 5-day, where you allow people to mingle, talk, grow. Everyone should hear the couple story. Everybody should hear something of how they came to meet, how they began to play, what they've learned from one another already. There's so much more conversation we need to have rather than just a wedding. So I'm pushing back, saying, no, I want more than that for you. But at least I'm asking that when you stand in front of me, I'm looking at the two of you, and we come to this moment in which who gives this woman to be married to this man, and at the point where I'm with my daughter, I had the opportunity to walk her down the aisle. My best friend did that particular portion, and then once I gave my daughter over, I came around, and now I want them at some point in the ceremony to thank me and her mother, and his mother and father. I want them to make public declarations of who they have become. And I suggested to my children, it's okay to do it in any, you can do it thematically, but I really think in this sense, chronologically would really be helpful. Start with kindergarten. And, you know, it's a large quantity, but think year by year who you became as a result of us, both good and ill, and talk. Speak to me. Speak to us. Speak and in that sense, be able to say, we are so grateful. We are here together in large measure because of what our families have provided us. So to be able to look at each one and say, thank you. But not just thank you, but stories to be able then to say, thank you. But at the end of it, to be able to say, Mom, I want you to understand from the moment I turn my back on you that I will never let your voice be primary. I will never let your voice have louder power in my life as I once did when I turned my back on you. Our relationship will radically and for the rest of my life change. Dad, thank you. But I want you to understand your presence, your voice, your desires. In fact, what I said to my children was, tell us publicly that you will not spend the first or even second Thanksgiving with us, or the first or second Christmas with us, or with those in-laws. Why? Because you need time to develop the matters of your own family's perspective on how you celebrate, how you honor, how you grow. So we will be separating from you. We will not be in contact with you as we have. We love you. We are grateful. And we thank you for the freedom for us to begin to connect at this level. Now, do you understand? If I were to have that done, there are in-laws, there are parents, there are people sitting in that audience, including my wife, who's really going, really? Does this really need to be done? And the answer is, for God's sake, yes. Did you do it? No. Are you ready to do it? No. Why? Because you're trying to balance loyalties. So you're playing a game with your kids. Your sister calls. What do you say? Hey, pause. I'll be back. Can we just hold the game for another 15 minutes? I'm not saying to you that this is a rote decision, that you always do this. But are you free to be able to say to your sister, hey, I'm on Park Place right now, and I am so close to finally crushing my children. And I love you, and I know you're hurting, but I am about to win Monopoly, and I will call you back in 2 hours. Are you free to do that? Or would there be a rift? Would there be a sense of, who do you think you are? I called, I'm in trouble, I need you, I want you right now. So the question really comes back to this, to whom will you be most loyal? And if the loyalty is shredded, or if it's dispersed, I think what you will find overall, there will be a lack of trust, because what comes with loyalty is trust. Do you see the category of faith here? Marriages must grow in trust together, and they will only grow in trust when you take the huge risk with a young bride or a husband when you say, I have tethered myself to you, and I will not depend upon my world as it once was. Now, what does that also include? Please hear the next point. It includes not just people like your mother and father, your brother and sister, but it includes far more diverse things like this, something as simple and yet difficult as this. To whom will you be more loyal? To your past sexual abuse or to your new spouse? I'm going to talk about sexual abuse in a little bit, and I do not want you to mishear me. I'm not saying you can have a history of abuse and basically go, well, I'm done with it because I'm married now. That is stunningly ridiculous. But what I'm asking of you is, will you know that if you've been abused, it is going to influence your marriage? It's going to affect how you trust, how you have conversations, and how you have sex. So what are you going to do? Push it aside and go, oh, it's in the past. I let the blood of Christ cover that. Now I'm just forward. Oh, no. You can't do that. You can't do that with any trauma in your life. You can't do that with any sin in your life. You cannot do that with any addiction or loyalty past in your life. So in other words, a marriage is meant to be a healing place. We'll get to that in the last Roman numeral. You're meant to be healed as a result of your marriage, which only then requires that I begin to own certain realities. I know questions like this often come up. How honest should I be about my sexual past with my wife? Should I tell her everything? Should I tell him everything? And the answer is, oh, God, help us. No! Why? Because it's not for them that you'd be divulging. You're sort of cleansing yourself of all the junk in you, hoping that a divulgence, almost a vomiting, will sort of free your stomach from the nausea. That's not honest. That's not kind. It's not committed. What do you share? You share whatever is necessary for that other person to know you well. So when we got married, I didn't know anything about sexual abuse. It wasn't something that I withheld from my wife. I just hadn't the integrity at that point to be able to name my past as having abuse. My wife had been sexually abused as well. She knew that there was abuse, but was so ashamed of it that she didn't tell. So we both entered into our marriage unaddressing, unaware of the reality of past harm. So when I get to the issue of loyalty, it's this. Will you make your spouse the center passion of your life with this core question? What entangles me from running my race well to love them as I'm meant to do? And if you've got a history of depression, we know that depression has a genetic history. So you come from a family where there has been some significant level of mental illness, depression at least. You think you can just click that off, just decide somehow to get above it? Or are you going to have the integrity to say, this could be something past, present, that entangles me, that keeps me from being able to run the race of loving my spouse well? Well, then what do you need to do? You need to deal with it. The commitment to deal with loyalty is to say, I don't make you the core of how I'm living out my relationship with Christ. But I also know that's what I'm meant to do and what I want to do. And I'm open to dealing with where my past addictions, where my past sexual abuse, where my immorality, where my promiscuity, where my last deceit actually is continuing today to have an effect. So simple. Will you be loyal? And that requires turning from what has held you before. And what held you? Shame. What held you? Fear. What held you? Bondage of self-righteousness. What held you? Your mother. Now, are you willing to at least name some of what has held you from being able to run well? And if you're willing to do that, you have begun the process of leaving. So is it ever done? No. Maturity is never done. We're never done leaving our mothers and fathers. So when you say past tense, oh, I left my mother and father when we got married, all I want to say to you is, that's fantastic. And how have you left in the last week, month, year, 2 years, 5 years? My father has been dead since August 9th, 1991. So almost 20 years. And there are things about my father's life I have come to bless in those 20 years since he died. And there are parts about his life that has become clearer and clearer to me of the shadow of his own sin as indeed a force over my own heart and life. And whether you call it generational sin, whether you call it just the impact of modeling, or whether you call it spiritual warfare, I just want you to hear this phrase. We are on the road to more repentance, not less. And so you, whether you've been married 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, you should be aware that you're leaving that past loyalty or any loyalty more and more and more. First task, leave. Second, cleave. This has to do with how we communicate. Let me talk about several of the core issues with regard to communication, and then we'll begin to talk about what cleaving looks like. There are a couple of things you can do that are disastrous with regard to communication. First and foremost is a term I've used called DMZs, demilitarized zones. I think most marriages have DMZs. And what a DMZ is technically is, you probably know, between North and South Korea is about a 4 to 8 mile strip of land that is considered to be a no person's land. No man, no woman's meant to walk there. You walk into that ground, both sides, North and South Korea, virtually have the right to shoot you because no one should be there. What I see happening in most marriages is this. We attempt to have conversations that are difficult about your mom, about sex, about what we're doing with our money, how we're dealing with disciplining our son or daughter. And the moment we get into this conversation, you can feel your body change. Your brain, in the midst of anxiety, produces a number of rise of adrenaline, noradrenaline, norepinephrine, but let me use a key word, cortisol. And as your cortisol raises, what tends to happen is that your heart rate goes above 106 to 8 beats per minute. And this is what research indicates, that if you go above 108 beats per minute, there is no productivity that will occur because you are in the middle of what could be called a limbic hijacking. Very simply, you have a part of your brain we call the thinking part of our brain called the cortical. Then you have another portion of our brain we often call the feeling part of our brain called the limbic system. And what research has indicated pretty clearly is that our thinking, cortical, is not in control of our feeling, limbic. In fact, we think feeling before we think thoughts. Our bodies respond to the world without our bringing literal thought to the process. So before most of us even know we're in a fight, we feel like we're in a fight. Before we know there's conflict, our bodies feel conflict. And for many of us, we are so brilliant, we don't even have to think this, but we have a way to sort of lower our metabolism, lower our heart rate by simply backing off. Literally, physically backing away, or internally saying, I'm not going to talk about it. Or literally just sort of like going blank. And what happens to the cortisol? It lowers. How do you feel when the cortisol lowers? Better. Again, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. But if I were to say, I'm going to pick one of you in the next moment to come up and just share a few things that you've learned over the span of this morning. So let me take somebody from this section. What almost would happen? Literally, my guess is, as I'm looking at you, would you not agree that all of a sudden you felt a little like, is he kidding? He's kidding. He already said he's kidding. Is he kidding? Is he kidding? Meaning, you don't need to see a snake to go, oh, snake. You just saw a pile, a wound up cord, and your body responded. Well, it's a gift of God, and yet that gift so often gets misused so that when we begin to feel arousal, that kind of a anxiety, we have our ways to lower it. Well, one of the classic ways is simply to stonewall. So let me just use one phrase. Stonewalling kills marriages. Well, how do you feel? I don't know. That's stonewalling. There the question is, I don't know, is it with an exclamation point, a period, comma, semicolon, a dash? I don't know, but let me talk out loud. Do you hear? That's so different. So what do you want to do for vacation? I don't know. I don't really care. Stonewalling. When you resist conversation, You're basically putting a wall between you and your spouse. What happens then? Usually for one person, it raises anxiety. For the other, it lowers it. And now we are limbically, brain-wise, we're in different worlds. You are aroused, and I'm calm and distant. What happens? No empathy, no connection, no possibility of cleaving. So here's the core question. Will you keep away from DMZs? Will you name them and say, this is a DMZ in our marriage? Whenever we talk about your mother, things go badly. So what we've learned is this. We love each other. We love each other. We get along. We enjoy one another. It's just your mom's off topic. So can't go there. Why should we go there? She's not that central. She's not around that often. She doesn't get that much power in our relationship. So why should we have conflict when we get along so well? Why bother? Here's the answer. DMZs are where evil plants. It's deep discord and division. Always. You give ground to evil, it will use it. You give ground because you're afraid. Evil will intensify the fear. Where you choose to not face reality together, you turn because this is a prettier view for you to look at. Behind your back, evil will sow seeds of discord that will, over 5, 10, 15 years, simply divide you further and further and further and further. And most of the people in this audience have one or two areas in your marriage that you know you are not prepared to go deal with tonight. And I beg of you, don't. I beg of you, don't take today and ruin it by trying to have conversations you are not prepared for. Any more than I were to say to you, you know, when is it, March or April in Chicago, something called the marathon, half marathon. That's what I want you to do. Don't train, don't prepare. Sign up and run the half marathon in your sweltering 80 degree, humid to a point of a taste of hell summer. Not smart. Why? Because you've not done the work to have the right to be at that spot. But what do you need to do? You need to mark the DMZs. Can you do that? Yes, you can do that. As long as you make that kind commitment, we're not going there tonight. We're not going there tomorrow. We're not going there in a week or two. But we know, don't we? Can't we at least say, when we talk about sex, things don't go well. We've got too much of a long history after a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years to not know. We know this is not easy terrain for us. At least name them. And part of the task is then you're not stonewalling. At least at that point, you're not saying there's going to be an inevitable wall between us that will always be there. Just learn to live with it. Suffer it. You got a lot of other benefits in our marriage, so just endure it. That is wrong. Second error that is almost always destructive, and it's a simple word, contempt. Nothing kills marriages more than contempt. John Gottman, the gentleman who used to teach, still does, at University of Washington, runs what's called the Love Lab. Nobody has done better research about marriage than John Gottman and his colleagues. And one of the things they did was they can determine in simply 2 hours, at 85% level of accuracy, whether a couple will be divorced within 3, 5, 7, or 12 years. That is unbelievable. And what's the basis? Contempt. And again, this isn't a formula, but what they have found by research is there needs to be a minimum of 6 kind reflections, remarks, interactions, tender, kind. I don't like the anemic word positive, but whatever you take to that. 6 remarks like, I am so appreciative of how you handled that conflict last night. You know, you look so good in that suit. It doesn't have to be rocket science level depth. It just needs to be 6 kinds of remarks that say to the other, I like you, to one category of criticism. Could you possibly address the snowfall on your shoulder that appears to be at least an inch thick? People are going to wonder whether it was snowing in the car, given the dandruff on your shoulder. That's not awful. That's not an awful thing to say. But let's say that's 6, and there's one remark like, hey, thanks for getting my lunch today. Here's the data. A marriage will not survive unless there's a 6-to-1 relationship. 6 kind of remarks that indicate, I like you. to one remark that is meaningfully an attempt to address a problem or a conflict or a critique. So you're 3-3, your marriage is in trouble. 1-1 relationship, your marriage is in trouble. 4 critical remarks, 1 positive, your marriage is really not going to survive. So this isn't a matter of having a counter like, hey, I like your shoes. Your hair looks great. What a great lunch. Boy, that was a thoughtful card you wrote to Joan. You keep the house really nice. Will you stop complaining about if it becomes tedious and mechanical? It's dead. But at least you have a criteria to say, are you contemptuous? And contempt is when you roll your eyes. Contempt is when you say the word, really? Really? Contempt is where you go, what's it going to take? Do you have any idea how it is to put 2 + 2 together? I mean, could we just begin with basic math? When you're demeaning, when you belittle, when you find fault in a way in which you know you are attempting to make the other pay, there's almost nothing you can do that is more destructive to your marriage. So 2 categories so far, withdrawal and contempt. When there is those 2 present, either withdrawal or contempt, you already have a kind of disaster at play. So what's involved if we begin to refocus on what it means to cleave in a new way? First word, key word, is the word curiosity. I don't know how a marriage grows without curiosity. And another word for that, just parallel, is the idea of intrigue. Are you intrigued with what your spouse does? Now, if there's already a long-standing presence of contempt or withdrawal, when you ask a question like, truly, what were you thinking? There's going to be that bristle. Like, I have to explain myself, defend myself. I have to give you justification. That's when a spouse needs to step back and go, I am so sorry. Clearly, I've asked that question now or in the past so poorly that you felt under my scrutiny and my judgment. And I don't know how to say it better and more simply than, I am so, so sorry. I don't know how you think. I don't know how you reason. I don't know how you come to some of the sentences and conclusions. My wife and I, years ago, came out of a meeting with someone we did not know before but had heard a lot about. And as we're walking to the car, my sentence to my wife was, wasn't that a good night? And my wife said, That's not a resounding response. And my first response to her in that moment was, what's your problem? She said, well, at the moment, this instant, you. Really? Really? How? Are you asking? I used an interrogative. Yeah, but some of your interrogatives are slaps in the face. Oh, what's going on? I just said, wasn't it a good evening, and we're already in conflict. Yep, we are. Glad you acknowledged that. Yeah, well, it's tense. She goes, will you be curious tonight about my view? You've already made your judgment. It was a lovely night. It's not how I viewed it. It's not how I experienced the time. So how open are you to this conversation? And that was a really interesting question. How open are you? It's a question you need to be asking one another. Now, can it be overused? Can it be misused? Can anything be overused, misused? Of course. But it is a question. How open is your heart right now? Is this a conversation you're willing to allow to expand, to go in directions you might not expect? Are you open to what might happen if we have this conversation? And you as a spouse need to be able to return, to be able to go, I'm sorry, it's like 10:30 at night. It's been a long night. I don't think so. Is it okay to say to one spouse, I'm not ready right now? Absolutely yes. But what do you need to do? Bridget, well, I would like to have this conversation. I'm glad to not do it tonight. I think we'll lose a little of the intensity and a little of what I want to say, but would you be willing to have this conversation tomorrow at breakfast? No. Well, want to come home an hour early from work? No. In other words, you don't have this conversation. Right. I just wanted to say, well, a good night, and you say no. Do you see the tensions that are there? that's where you have to be able to go back and go, do we want to really be together? Do we really want to be together to work on this? I thought it was a great night, and my wife then says, well, I need to know, are you open? And it's like, okay, we've got about a 35-minute drive. Are you okay having this conversation in the car? Most of the time, I don't think it's wise to have meaningful conversations in a car. When I have a meaningful conversation, I want to look at the person. And my ability to drive is not good even when I'm concentrating. And so to have a conversation, my wife a number of times has said, please, we can keep talking, look at the road. Okay, so we're driving along and she says, open? Yes. Not easy? Yes. Yes. Are you willing to let this conversation go on more than just tonight? Yes. 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 Looking at her going, is it that important? She goes, I think it's deeply important. It's just a nice night. Okay. Her first words were, you're a better therapist than what you observed with what this man said and did to his wife. What do you mean? Did you see how he demeaned her? Apparently not. She begins to tell me the story of what happened. And as soon as she began to tell me the story, it was like, oh my gosh, he did say that. He did sort of put his hand over his wife's mouth once. I didn't see it. Next sentence. Dan, honey, why were we eating with them tonight? And then I could feel it. I mean, again, I'm not a terribly bright man, but when she said that simple sentence, why were we dining with them? Well, I was hoping eventually he might donate to the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. Oh. So, in other words, you have eyes to see when it's somebody paying you to be your client, but when this might be a donor who benefits the school you're part of, somehow your eyes just don't seem to be working. And inside of me, I'm going, don't you mess here, girl. Don't you mess. You're talking trash here, and you want to talk about your failures of sight? You want to talk where you're naive, where you let yourself be bullied? I'll tell. And do you hear those moments where you're going, oh, Jesus. And that's a very key point. Oh, Jesus. I don't know how you're going to have meaningful conversations unless you know how to say, oh, Jesus. Damn it. I'm right back. I'm right back to where I was. Has there been any maturity, any growth, any goodness? I can feel it in my craw. Like, I'm not easily seduced that a donor might give us $10,000 or $20,000 will keep me from seeing how demeaning he is to his wife and never address it? And my wife has to name it? Yeah. Yeah. So here's the question. Are you open? Will you surrender to hard questions and conversations? Will you be curious? And when the tension begins to come, will you name it and go, right now, I feel tension with you. I'm looking at your face. Your face feels hard to me. Yeah, I feel hard. You seem angry. You're right. Brilliant one. You're right. I'm angry. Okay. Can we stay together? Can we not divide, stonewall? Can we not blame, accuse, contempt one another? Do you see those two guardrails? Don't be a coward and back off. Don't be cruel and murder. I don't know what to do in the middle. I don't know what you're thinking. I'm going to tell you here's three steps. I don't know any steps. I'll make steps up for you if you want. They're not true, but they might look good in your notes. I just know I want to back off. I want to back off. I want to back off. And something inside of me has to be crying out with the Spirit of God saying, I also want to be mean. You can tell I'm a verbal man. I've been in a lot of conflicts, a lot of bar fights, literal bar fights. Had guns held to my head. I've held guns to other people's head. I've lived a violent life. I'm not afraid of violence. And so when I'm in a fight with my wife, she's in for it. And I've got to not so much control my anger. I've got to be able to say, this is not the man I want to be. Now, calm, own, I'm angry, I want to make you pay. You've said something that has some truth, a lot of truth, maybe entirely true, but I can't yet admit it. Not fully. Stay with me. Do you hear what I'm underscoring? I don't know how you pray, but for me, most of the time in those moments, it's just literally, Jesus, help me. Help me. Let me just engage what I know to be true, what I want to be true, what I want my heart to be. So what does it mean to cleave? It means to be curious enough to not allow defenses to win, to ruin the possibility of what might creatively come. Is this going to be painful? Yes. Hard? Yes. At times, you simply don't agree or believe that the other person sees what's true. Do you have to have agreement to have cleaving? No. Second word, honor. You must honor. I don't agree with you, but I also know you're not a fool. I don't agree with you. I simply know, frankly, you've been a lot more accurate than you've been wrong. So please take me through what you're thinking again. Let me take notes on it. I literally at times had to say to my wife, to slow my heart rate down, to keep from responding because I'm a very verbal man, I need to take notes to hear what you're saying to be able then to come back and go, am I really saying, hearing what you said? This is hard work. But it's that important that my wife feels like I am laboring with curiosity and honor. Honor meaning I know you speak. Never fully and never completely, but you speak on behalf of God into my life. Will you trust that the voice of God, maybe like Balaam's ass, is braying through your spouse? It's still the voice of God. But other times, it's the melodic voice of an angel inviting you to a level of truth. Will you honor that and say, I'll think about it, I'll pray about it, I'll reflect on it, I will not dismiss you? If you'll do those two things, be open and curious and honor. And then third, our task is to think together implicationally. A lot of thought that comes by putting things to words literally ends up spinning you into realities you were unaware of and could never have come to and to have understood in the way that you will now. And so thinking implicationally begins to build us together. So a question like, we have vacation plans we need to make for our July and August of this coming year. So when my wife says, what do you want to do? I go, well, I like to fly fish. I want to visit with this person, love to go here. And she said, those are all great plans. Those are all great dreams. Those are, that if that's what we do this summer, great. I'm going, what's next? She goes, I'd rather you answer this question. You talk about actuarial tables. I've heard you speak before. And you're turning 60 this summer. And you've got 16 years left on this earth. You know, it's one thing to say it in public. It's another to have your spouse say it. And she goes, I want you to make sure you have utilized your summer, given that you only have 16 more left on this earth. In the way that is not convenient, that is not just your own natural, this is what I prefer, but will you really begin to ponder with me what you want to dream for the last 16 years of our lives? Well, that's not entirely. I was like, oh, I don't want to think that. I don't want to talk about my death, nor do I want to talk about it. I only have 16 left. That really does, shall we say, bring a whole new reality to the conversation. With 16 summers left, what do you want to do? What do you want to see? It trivializes it to even use the culturally acceptable word bucket list. It's not a bad word. But the bottom line is far more, what do you want to see God grow in you for others on this earth before you depart? Is that a bucket list question? Bucket list is, you know what, you want to visit Thailand before you die? Fine. You want to jump out of an airplane before you die? Fine. I don't call it so much small or trivial as, really, it's not that much. I'm talking about, what do you want to bring to this earth through this next summer? And one of the things my wife said to me was, almost every year when we get to January, you begin talking about how you'd like to learn Spanish, and you do nothing about it. True. She goes, you want to go to language school this summer? My wife is listening to my dreams that I'm not faithful to, and calling me as a helpmeet. And that conversation was tense. I didn't like it. And the next question that you need to be asking is, do you allow language, prayer, to be part of your conversations with your spouse? My wife and I take about a 3.3 mile walk, about four times a week. And it's where we enunciate, mostly from the moment we begin walking, the things that we need to pray together. We pray in other seasons, yes, but it is where we particularly have the ritual of being able to walk and pray together. So are you open? Do you honor? Are you willing to think implicationally? And truly, will you let prayer be part of how you enunciate your heart's desire before one another and before God? Will you make it not a formal part, but in many ways a ritual of where you walk, where you talk, of what you do on a Sunday morning for an hour and a half? Will you let prayer become more of a rich fabric of how you unite? Our abilities to unite open the door to our sexuality. And because I've entirely lost track of who I am, where I am, or what time it is. Oh, goody. More time. Let's deal with the third issue, sexuality. I'm making an assumption. I'm making the assumption that you know that you can't have good sex unless you leave your mother and father. You can't have good sex if you're more loyal to your past abuse than you are to your spouse. You cannot have good sex if there are greater loyalties in your life than your spouse. So don't pressure your spouse for better sex when she knows you are a work addict. You live your life for your work. Your passion is your work. You want better sex. Okay. Then repent. Let's start with the error that your loyalty is to money. Oh, but you're providing for your family. I know that line. I've used it for decades. I'm just trying to provide for my family. I'm just trying to get my kids through school. Yeah. You are a work addict. So deal with your loyalties. First, you want better sex? Good. Deal with the loyalties that keep sex from occurring. You want better sex? Good. Learn to talk. Don't want to talk? No sex. That's God. That's not women. That's not women saying, until we talk, we can't have sex. A woman might say that or might not say that. A man might say that or a man might not say that. It's just biblical. Until you unite, when there is a growing sense of curiosity, honor, a willingness to work implicationally together, the ability to not turn to contempt or withdrawal. Yeah, you'll have better sex. But don't expect better sex unless you're wanting to talk. Now, what's going to happen as you do that is that maybe, and here's the dilemma, your sexuality may be doing great right now, and I'm about to ruin it. The kingdom of God is worth that. There's no humor in it. Some of you have great sex because you have very little else. You're orgasmic? Congratulations. It binds you in a way in which there's a kind of goodness and intimacy? Fantastic. You can't talk. You're not loyal. So are you surprised that people can have good sex that binds them together? Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 6 when he says, when you unite yourself with a prostitute, there's a kind of connection that he calls a spirit connection. Sex unites. And so if you don't have that good of a marriage and you've got good sex, it's possible to have the marriage be okay until you start dealing with these categories. And then it doesn't go okay because your good sex is not good sex. Why is it not good sex? Because orgasm is not the point. It's a great point. But it's not the core. What's the core? Worship, awe, gratitude, the ability to be able to say, wow, thank you. For the other to be able to say, yes, you're welcome, and yes, thank you. So if you've forgotten where we were, when we get to sexuality, it's a war. So what I want to do, first of all, is to talk about the norm male, the norm female. Sex has four parts to it. It's kind of stuff that's worth taking notes. Not much else is. Four parts. First part is desire. That is a formal section of sexuality, desire. I'm just going to tell you the parts, then we'll start putting words to them. First part is desire. Second part is what's called plateau. Third is called orgasm. And the fourth part is called decline. You've got four parts: desire, plateau, orgasm, decline. Let me further define. Desire is when you become aware, internally, physically, thought, feeling-wise, that you are aware of desire for sex, for arousal, to want to be involved sexually. And desire, for a man or a woman, moves the body to the second stage, plateau. Plateau is the progress of the body to a point where, as a male or as a female, you have the capacity to have an orgasm. Vasodilation happens in the penis. It's called an erection. A man cannot have an orgasm without an erection. And even if that happens quickly at 3 or 4 seconds or 30 seconds or a minute or two, it still has to occur for there to be an orgasm. No different for a woman. Vasodilation occurs clitorally. And what we know, even in the last 7 to 8 years, is the clitoris actually engorges with blood very, very similarly to a penis. And a woman's capacity for an orgasm is indeed entirely tied to clitoral arousal, period. So stage two for a man and woman, similar. It requires vasodilation to a point of erection to the capacity for the body to be able to have, third, an orgasm. And after an orgasm, stage four, there will obviously be a decline in arousal, a decline in tumescence or erection, and there will be a movement toward flaccidity, at least anatomically, and to a kind of quiescence or rest with regard to heart, body, soul. Four stages. So let me act out sex for you. You really did not know fully what you were getting for your money. So I'm going to do, I don't have an overhead. I don't believe in overheads. And actually, people don't have any overheads anymore in churches, do they? Yeah, last overhead I used was about 12 years ago, and I turned it on, and I had water, and I spilled it, and it, for some reason there must have been wiring that was crossed because it began to smoke and then exploded. So now you have things like pads, don't you? Blaine, don't you have pads? So I could put this on a pad, but I don't like pads because that means I have to learn how to use it. So I'd rather act it out. You can draw it. I'm going to do the four stages for a woman first. Or should it be a man? What do you think? Somebody said man. I'll do man first. Okay. So zero desire to desire. It changes in about 7 to 15 seconds. A man can go from no desire to desire very quickly. Primarily what we know in the limbic system is that what is ocular, what is seen, has more power to arouse a man generally than a woman. Given my wife's beauty versus my beauty, I am so grateful to God for that. But I'm more aroused visually than my wife is. But that's not so much because I'm more sexual than she is. If I could take away that notion that a woman is less sexual, it's nonsense. She's different sexual. I'm more ocular sight oriented for arousal. So arousal can occur in a very brief period of time. To the beginning of sexual desire with the process of tumescence, a man can come to a point of having an erection probably in the range of 30 seconds to 2 to 3 minutes. Longer than 2 to 3 minutes might be a small indication of erectile dysfunction. So in other words, it's a brief period from desire to tumescence or to erection. So as a man comes to that point, a man is now capable of having an orgasm. So as a man comes to an orgasm, so if I'm acting it out, it's like no desire and now there's a peak. That's the first stage. No desire, peak. Now, what happens with a peak is that it moves quickly to an erection. So from here, we'll do this. That's my acting. Now he's at the point where he has the capability of having an orgasm. Now, it doesn't mean that at that point of capacity, he needs to have an orgasm. But 72% of men struggle with premature ejaculation, meaning they aren't capable of keeping themselves from having an orgasm because the arousal is so pleasurable and they have not developed the muscular self-control to be able to stop it. Is there a cure for that? 92% cure rate with what's generally called the squeeze technique. Problem with that is less than 20% of men who have erectile premature ejaculation ever seek treatment or ever will go through it. So it means there are a lot of women who end up making love to men who have an orgasm too quickly in a way in which they cannot possibly please their spouse. So in other words, so we're acting it out. So we're coming here quick now, comes to a point of having an orgasm, whether it be a minute later, 2 minutes later, 10 minutes later, then, okay, here's the orgasm. Now we've ended the third stage because for a man, an orgasm will be singular, intense, and brief. Note those words. Singular, intense, and brief. Now what happens? Stage four, plummet. Quickly. You get the point? Stage one, fast. Stage two, fast. Stage three doesn't need to be fast, but sadly for many men, yes, it is fast. Stage four, quick decline, crash and burn. Ready for women? Desire. But if you hear critique or fault or even false humor, you're really wrong. Why? Because a woman's desire is primarily relational, not ocular. A man is aroused visually. Again, not to say this is all or nothing. Is it possible for a woman to be aroused sight-wise? Of course. For a man to be aroused relationally? Of course. I'm talking about that kind of that, which foot is first, the right or the left? Well, for a woman, relationship. How a woman is cared for is more erotic than what she sees. And so, how you take out the trash in the morning, how you deal with conflict in the afternoon, how you engage in thoughtful interactions is far more erotic for a woman, arousing. Again, you have to say, who made us this way? And you know the answer. So, desire, meandering. Arousal begins. And what I would say is, remember how I did it for a man? Sort of desire, movement. For a woman, it's more like, now, what creates that variance? Well, here, she remembered that she didn't put the pot roast in. Who knows how it got to here, but when it got to here, it's because she heard the dog barking two blocks away and began to wonder, is that Jimmy's dog? And if you're going to say, come on, wife, concentrate. What you have to hear is a woman's relational network is worlds more complex. And are you going to fundamentally say, stop being relational, be sexual, is a way of saying, don't be a woman. I want you to be like a man. Really? That's what you want? You want your wife to be like a man. Sexually, you want your wife to be like a man. There are problems with that category. So now to say, no, this meandering movement that has a kind of fragility, but depth and beauty, finally gets to the third stage. And maybe it doesn't have always the same level of intensity, but what can be said is it's much longer. It's not 3 to 5 seconds. It can be much longer. And not only much longer, but also more often, meaning there's the possibility of another and then another. Technically, there's no limit to the possibility of orgasms. And to that I say to God, what? And all he says to me back is, heaven. Okay. Stage four. It can feel endless. Please hear, sex doesn't end with an orgasm. Not for a woman. Sex ends for a woman with cuddling, with touch, with spooning, with caress. What's a man doing? Sleep. What's a woman desiring? Connection. Connection? Sex is over. No, it's not. Sex is as much in the decline as it is in desire and plateau and orgasm. Ah, is it not obvious? Who made the madness? Was brilliant. Gloriously brilliant. God is gloriously brilliant. Why? Because sex is meant to not work. You think it's supposed to work. What have you been watching? The Hollywood version? Madison Avenue version? The boasting claims from locker room versions? Who do you believe here? Sex was never meant to work easily, naturally, or well. Why? It's too important. Way too important. It is meant to work, yes, but never easily, never naturally, never well. What is it meant to do? It is meant to be the context where we push into the end of Genesis chapter 2, when it says, and they were naked, and they knew no shame. I got enough shame sexually to last me a lifetime. Abuse with a scoutmaster. Abuse in locker rooms with older boys. Abuse at a camp that for 9 weeks would have been nothing but a sexual torture camp. I know what it is to be abused by a single man. I know what it is to be humiliated by 3 or 4 who are each taking their turns to do their harm. I know the sound of laughter and mockery and cruelty. And I am not a mere victim, because I have done harm. I have used men, I have used women, I have done harm to myself, I have done harm to others. What am I to do with my sexual history? It's under the blood of Christ. It's covered. Brother, you don't need to think about it because you're a new creation in Christ. Your mockery? You better. It's true. That's the problem. It is true. True. I'm a new creature. And I'm covered in the blood of Christ. And my sins are forgiven. And there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And nothing can separate you from the love of God. Neither powers nor principalities. Demons or angels. The past or the present. Nothing. Now have the courage to step into it. Step into your arousal. Has there been perversion in your life? You tell me one of you that has escaped it, and I'll look at you both with incredulity, like, really? Really? And then I'll look at you with, thank you, that one of you, and an audience of 1,000. But that's that record. There's 1 out of 1,000 in this room who truly has escaped perversion. So the question is, when was your first moment of entry into pornography? Do you understand that as a young boy, someone showed me pornography? I didn't look for it. I didn't ask for it. But as a 12-year-old boy, I end up in Paris with my mother, and I attend the Moulin Rouge with her sitting in the front row, having no clue whatsoever what I was about to see. And within moments, undressed women, very brilliantly, large-breasted, beautiful women, are literally dancing within feet of my face. So my first encounter with pornography was with my mother. What was yours? Do you think yours was normal and mine abnormal or perverse? I doubt there are many men in this room who had their first encounter with a prostitute because their mother gave you $50 when you're 13 years of age in the red light district of Amsterdam to go spend the day, spend it any way you wish. My mother failed profoundly. Those are conversations my mother and I have had. My mother is grieved. She had her own justifications. She had her own failure of logic and love. But what's your first encounters? What is your sexual history? And do you think your sexual history is not marked with the design of evil to steal your innocence, to ruin the pleasure of receiving and giving with honor and glory? Evil hates sex, period. God loves it. And evil has been working to ruin you, to blight your face since you were born. What's your sexual shame? You don't think there's sexual shame in your life? Good Lord, have mercy. There is no more crowded room in your house, no more noisy room in your house than your bedroom. So who's there? Past boyfriends, girlfriends, past abusers, fantasies, pornography. And you're trying to make love to your wife. You're trying to make love to your husband. And what do you think all that noise is doing? It's whispering and it's shouting. Remember me? Remember this touch? Remember what you felt like when? Oh, give yourself to him. Give yourself to her. But when you get up, you're going to walk by me, aren't you? You're going to remember me, won't you? Sex is fun, huh? Wasn't so fun the night three of us held you down, was it? No, it wasn't. Nor was it that fun when you violated that woman in that way that evening, was it? No, it was not. Then what will you do with your own sexual history? Do you know why sex doesn't go well? You don't have the courage to leave past loyalties. Because to leave, you must name. To name, you've got to look face to face. And I've got to be able to say with each person I have been sexual with, be it my own victimization or my own misuse of them, I need to be able to have the courage to look them in the eye and to be able to break the power they have to hold some portion of my life with accusation and shame. How do you do that? I can't tell you in a few moments. There's no tricks. You don't pull a little rabbit out of the hat. But you have the integrity to begin to say, no, I'm going to deal with my abuse. 65, never talked about it with any human being. Yes, older boys showed me pornography. Yes. Older boys masturbated in front of me. Yes. Older boys made me masturbate in front of them. Yes. Did one of them touch me weirdly? Yes. Is that sexual abuse? You darn well better believe it is. Now, what do you want to do with it? Blood of Christ. Yeah, blood of Christ to have the integrity to face it and name it and not allow it to have power in your life anymore. What does it mean to then be able to say, I have to have conversations with my wife? To be able to say to her, I want to make love. That was said a few weeks ago, and my wife looked at me and she goes, really? You do? I said, yeah. She goes, and why haven't you talked with me, approached me? Why has there been almost no sexual contact for the last 10 days to 2 weeks? Would you believe busy? No. There have been busier periods in your life. You've been distant. You've been disengaged. Do I want to make love? Yes, I'd love to make love. You want to go right now? Let's go. You want to talk, huh? Okay. I've been distant, disengaged. Felt it, wanted sex. For an orgasm? Yeah, love orgasms. But I wanted to feel close. But I wanted to feel close without the price of talking. She didn't want conflict, but she also knew she had to name that I'd been distant. Now we're in a conversation. Do you hear the progress? Leave. Have the integrity to talk, to engage. And then what is sex? What is sex meant? Let me give you one picture. I work with a man who struggled with homosexuality for many, many years. Again, I'm not going to speak about that reality, simply telling you the story of what happened. As I began to work with him, he was married. He had been married for almost a year and a half and had never consummated the marriage. And he was at war with a question of, am I gay and should just own up to it and indeed end my marriage? Or should I begin to move toward my wife sexually? I don't know how. And again, it's not like, well, here's what you do. Here are the 4 things, 10 things, 20 things. None of us know much of anything at all. All I said to him was, I'll help you begin to engage some of the areas and some of the ways in which you've hated having to live in a relationship with a woman who's other than you, whose body is not like yours, whose body doesn't respond the way yours responds, and how in many ways you've lived with her, at least in this particular marriage, in a way that's really cowardly. And as he began to deal with his own failure of love and strength and engagement, he began to change in relationship with her. And it was hard work for over almost 10 months. No sexual contact. I remember the day well. I came out to get them. They're waiting in my office. I looked in the, I opened my door, went out, and when I saw their faces, it was like, oh, baby, something has happened in their marriage. And I'm sort of looking at them like, well, come back. And I literally, first words were, something's very different. And he looks at me and he goes, twice. And I'm at times clueless. And I said, he goes, we had intercourse twice, and it was unbelievable. And I'm looking at him going, yes, tell me more. And as he began to tell me of the experience of them moving into a sexual relationship, he began to put words to what a war it was to give his body to a woman, how furious he felt against her and against his own body. But as he entered into the sexual relationship, he found something in his own heart with her and with himself, surrendering and calling it good. And after we partied 20-some minutes, just celebrating together, all of a sudden he looked at me and he goes, I have a question for you. Okay? He goes, let me tell you what happened after I made love to my wife the second time. He said, we touched, we cuddled, we talked, we prayed, we celebrated. It's really a big deal for us that we made love twice. And I held her. She wept in my arms. It's some of the sweetest moments, he said, I've enjoyed on this earth. He said, I let her fall asleep in my arms. And when I knew she was asleep, fully asleep, I got up quietly and I walked to my study and I simply sat in a chair. And he said, it was overwhelming. He said, I began to weep. And he said, the tears were not bitter. They weren't sweet. They weren't just relief. And I looked at him and I said, what words would you put to it? And he said, I don't know other than they felt like a living gift, not only to me, but I felt like it was a gift I was able to give to God. And then he looked at me and he said, is that what heterosexual men feel when they make love to their wives? And what am I to say as a heterosexual man to this man?
Right on, man. You've joined the rest of us, finally.
Now, what I had to tell him was this. No. No. It's not what your so-called heterosexual brothers feel after they make love. Very few men weep after they make love. Very few men wait with their spouse in their arms to let them sleep. Very few rise to go to their study or another room to sit and ponder what just happened. Very few men worship God because of the privilege to enter the body of another, to become what the language of Scripture speaks with such poetic brilliance. One flesh. Who am I when I am in my wife? My wife has surrounded me. Who are we? We are one. Who are we? We're neither ourselves nor we not. And what is sex? At one level, it is ecstasis. Ek, out, stasis, standing. Ecstasy isn't just wild pleasure. It's literally a way of standing outside of yourself, to no longer be who you are fully, and yet to become more fully who you are than at any other moment of your life. In other words, sex is probably one of the sweetest paradoxes of life. It's one of the great mysteries of life, that our bodies could touch, that there could be arousal, pleasure. And you see the very nature of what sex is. It's giving. Giving. Your lips give. Your hands give. Your private parts give. And it is receiving, allowing the other's touch to bring arousal. And yet the receiving brings the other pleasure. Giving gives the other pleasure. Giving and receiving gives you pleasure. It is a multiplicity of arousal and pleasure that literally leads for a brief moment to a kind of forgetfulness. That we have mortgages to pay and children to parent and dogs to walk and bills to pay. In other words, what is it? It's not long. Oh my gosh, it's not long. But it is a few particles of our life that give us the briefest look into what heaven will hold. Why would you want to deprive your spouse of that? Why would you want to deprive yourself of that? And the answer, shame. The answer, fear. The answer, anger. Those are the three great enemies to sex. You're too angry to make love to your wife. You're too angry to make love to your husband. Because that self-sacrifice, that self-opening, and that giving, when your spouse wants so little of you but sex. And most of the time, you think I'm likely referring to women because men want sex more. It's true and not true. I can tell you there are many women in this room, and I mean many women in this room, who would love for their spouse to be more sexual than he is. So we do these gender somersaults, assuming women are not sexual, men are. Men want more sex, women are less. Pressure and fight. Now, it can be just as much the other way around. Please hear me. There will almost never be equivalent desire, equivalent arousal, equivalent pleasure. Never exactly the same. So how we deal with one another in that variance of desire and pleasure and arousal becomes one of those core ways in which we go back to say, I'm loyal to you and to no one else. And I'm committed to language, to talk, to pray, to grow, to think, to deal with the issue of how my past may have influence over my life right now that is keeping me from being the man or the woman that indeed I wish to be on your behalf. But sex, simple touch. And I promise you, my wife and I, when we walk, not always, but sometimes, we hold hands. Do I every now and then hold one of my daughter's hands? When my son put his hand on my chest, we were walking streets of Sayulita, Mexico. And I looked at him and I said, hold my hand for a minute, would you? He goes, no. I said, Andrew, you were once a 7 and 8 year old boy. And when you were 7 and 8 years of age, when that story occurred, you'd let me hold your hand every now and then. Would you let me hold your hand just Mpoko, just a little? He goes, yeah. I held his hand. We walked about 6 steps. He goes, enough? I said, yeah. Good. Thank you. But nobody. Nobody. Nobody holds my wife's hand like I do. So where are you sexual with your spouse? Nobody touches my wife's face like I do. Nobody. Nobody touches mine. Nobody caresses my hair. Nobody holds my hand the way she does. We're not into many public displays of affection. But when the touch happens, it's electric. So what I'm arguing for us is this. Sex is our weapon against shame. And when you make love, we'll come to these categories in just a bit after a break. You make love, you're doing harm to the kingdom of darkness. If it is on the basis of loyalty and the basis of curiosity and honor, implication thinking, if you're growing sex, is a nail in the heart of evil. Every time you make love to your spouse and are able to thank God, thank each other, thank God just for the concept of a clitoris. I really want to know in eternity, what committee came up with that idea? So are you able to just go, wow, 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 what a concept. Intercourse, wild. To the degree that you are, you're saying to evil this, you, son of a bitch. You bastard. You bastard. You soulless, lifeless, motherless, hideous mark on this universe. You stupid son of a bitch. You did not win in my life. You thought abuse would take my soul. And it would turn me to a violent man who loved to carry a 9mm in the back of his pants and made a whole lot more money when I was 12 to 15 than I do today. You thought, oh, evil one, you won. You marked me. You put shame so deep within my heart that there would be no hope for life, no breath of goodness, no heart to surrender to beauty, no goodness. And you fool, you were wrong. Out of a beautiful book called Prince of Tides, Tom the protagonist, as he is about to see a wild animal devour men who are about to destroy, attempt to destroy his family. If you know where I'm speaking from this text, it is a beautiful line. And the protagonist says this, when you chose my house, you chose wrong. That sounds sweet. In my immorality, my choice. My past victimization, not my choice. Evil thought it won. And to be able to say, you chose to take my home down. You chose wrong. Have a good break.